All right, good evening and welcome to the season finale, Great Jewish Challenges. This is part six. I want to thank again our sponsors for this year, Becky and Avi Katz, Il Nishmat Yonah, Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and Becky and Avi have been known supporters of Torah, Marbitzei Torah, for many, many years, not just me, but many others as well, and I thank them very much for their sponsorship and their participation as well. Part six tonight, we'll be discussing one of the greatest Jewish challenges, freedom. We might think that after centuries of suppression, persecution, pogroms, maltreatment, and being treated as second-class citizens without rights or legal protections, and still mostly clinging to Torah observance, that Jews would have responded to freedom as it was known then, the emancipation, a product of the Enlightenment, with open arms and a willingness to serve Hashem amidst liberty and prosperity, to increase mitzvah observance, Torah study, to shine our light upon the nations that now welcome us. So we're discussing the era in which European countries and then the United States extended full rights of citizenship to Jews, and the Jews could have responded by integrating the Torah into this new age of opportunity. But no. Freedom has become, and still is, one of the greatest challenges to Jewish survival, which unleashed a greater wave of non-observance, intermarriage, and assimilation than persecution ever did. It's as if God said to us that in this final chapter of the era of history before Mashiach comes, he said, I've seen what you can do while suffering under the yoke of the nations. Let me see what you can do while enjoying their friendship and their bounty. It's actually quite amazing. For almost the entirety of the exile, Jews lived in oppressive conditions under feudal monarchs or dictators. About 15 years ago, it dawned on me that for the first time in centuries, if maybe ever, there was not one Jew in the world living under a dictator. There's been a backsliding of democracies since then, but nonetheless, it might not be true anymore, but still, overwhelmingly, most Jews today live in free or relatively free countries. But what is true is that I believe there's no Jew today living even in an unfree country who cannot leave if he wished to do so. So the aftermath of the emancipation is still present. But have we handled this freedom? Results have not been completely salutary, but let's understand what happened that the nation started according rights and freedoms to Jews. How do we respond? What went wrong? What went right? And what can we do in the future? So I want to first trace the causes of this new freedom, which is just a few centuries old, and I'm relying heavily on a work by Chaim Ben Sasson, who was a professor of history at Hebrew University, called History of the Jewish People. It's a culled from chapters 42 to 45. These are causes. The emancipation was the product of a swirl of factors, and as a movement began to spread across Western and Central Europe, first in the 1600s. Why? How did the world progress from monarchies and religious hegemony to equality and individual freedoms and ultimately democracy? So a number of causes. First, the Reformation spurred the growth of religious tolerance. So obviously not for Jews for the most part, but some did. Take, for example, Roger Williams of Rhode Island fame. He wrote in 1644 that Christianity can flourish even, I quote, with the contrary consciences of Jews or Gentiles, unquote. John Locke, who heavily influenced the American founders, wrote in 1689 a letter concerning tolerance, in which he stated that neither pagan, nor Mohammedan, nor Jew ought to be excluded from the civil rights in the Commonwealth because of his religion. And that played a great role in how the American founders established the American society. Montesquieu wrote in a similar vein. Thus, the emancipation was percolating in sophisticated European society long before it bore fruit. Conversely, in Eastern Europe, emancipation came slowly to Jews because the Reformation never arrived and the clergy remained dominant in a way that didn't exist in Western Europe, and Jewish civil rights were almost always connected to Jewish assimilation. That's the first reason, the Reformation. Secondly, there were utilitarian reasons which were especially embraced by Jews up to modern times, really up to today. In other words, we held that the worth of a citizen should be defined not by his religious traditions, but by his usefulness to the state. So on that basis, Jews clamored for rights and argued that Jews would be ideal citizens as we do not seek power and are responsible for the development of economies across Europe. Bankers, traders, investors, think of the British East India Company, the dominant exploration in which Dutch Jews were heavily invested. As a result, it was able to force Peter Stuyvesant to back down from his Jew-hating edicts, including expulsion of Jews from New York. Third and related was the Enlightenment, which began to sever the intimate connections between the state, its citizens, and the church, or formal religions. So this led many countries to reevaluate the place of Jews in society. And of course, and part of our story, is that there was tremendous pushback against this. One philosopher defined Jews as a parasitic plant in Europe, unworthy of rights or even residence. A German, Johann Fichte, asked in 1793, "Give them civil rights? I see no other way of doing this except to cut off all their heads one night and substitute other heads without a single Jewish thought in them." And then he added, "I see no alternative but to conquer their promised land for them and to dispatch them all there." In retrospect, how tantalizing is that? Thus, even as those nations move to some sort of recognition of the rights of citizens, extending those rights to Jews was always a conversation and usually a controversy. Even liberal countries tended to circumscribe the rights of Jews as pertaining to Jews as individuals, but not to Jews as a group, and to that we will return. Fourth, the emancipation, for some, was supported as a concerted effort to destroy our nation as Jews and recreate us as a better brand of citizen, what some Gentile writers of the time termed improvement. Of course, to us it sounds bizarre, but as we'll see, to a large extent it worked. Emancipation led almost inexorably to widespread assimilation, and thus there were rabbis who perceived equality and citizenship as a threat to Jewish survival and not as a benefit. They were not necessarily right, but they were not completely wrong either, as we found out in many contexts, especially the Western European and even the American ones. Fifth, and almost conversely, emancipation was viewed by some as rooted in the legal and philosophical traditions of the Jews and was thus embraced by many Hebraists. It was the influential group of thinkers who taught themselves Hebrew, Tanakh, and even some of later Jewish literature that we encountered a few lectures ago in our discussion of the Renaissance. So they joined together with intellectual followers of Spinoza, who were rebelling against the revealed religions and trying to substitute in its place human reason. So on some level, then, emancipation developed in the background of the war against Christianity. And full equality for all citizens would and did weaken the influence of the church on general society. So here's a brief history, practically what happened. So to give one example, the Empress of the Habsburg dynasty, that's Austria, Bohemia, Moravia, was Queen Maria Theresa, who ruled from 1740 until 1780. She hated Jews and she mistreated Jews in medieval style. Soon after she assumed power, on December 18th, 1744, she ordered the expulsion of all Jews in her domain, beginning with the Jews of Prague. And this is not so long ago. George Washington was alive already. Pressure was applied, and Jews were able to quash the order relating to Moravia and Bohemia, but the 20,000 Jews of Prague were expelled. And as was typical, they returned 4 years later and had to pay a special tax in order to live there. To be fair, she also persecuted Protestants. Her basic opinion of Jews, however, did not change. In 1777, she wrote of Jews, "I know of no greater plague than this race, which on account of its deceit, usury, and avarice is driving my subjects into beggary." Meaning every problem that existed in her domain could be blamed on the Jews. You know, it's no irony that the town of Terezin, famed as the site of the concentration camp Theresienstadt, was named for her. And she remains a heroine in Austria. Here's a fun fact about Maria Theresa, so to speak. She had 16 children. The youngest of them was Marie Antoinette, who became the last queen of France. She of the apocryphal "let them eat cake" fame, when told that the people had no bread to eat. And she was guillotined along with her husband, King Louis XVI, in 1793. So she had a big family. But Maria Theresa also had a son, Joseph II, who succeeded her and was much better disposed to Jews. It's all relative. In fact, the Jews admired him. On display in the Hofburg Palace in Vienna is a menorah that the Jews of Vienna gave to him as a gift, expressing their loyalty. I don't know if he ever lit it, but nonetheless, he believed in what he called enlightened absolutism. He was the ruler, absolute ruler, but he could be benevolent as well. So for a long time, he was co-ruler with his mother, mitigating some of her animosity towards Jews, and he even visited Yerushalayim in 1869. On January 2nd, 1782, his mother was dead and he was now the only ruler, so this Habsburg Emperor, Joseph II, issued what was called the Edict of Tolerance, allowing Jews to worship as they pleased. And this, 1 year after doing the same for Protestants and others. And in line with the second reason above, the utilitarian benefits of emancipation, Joseph wrote that the purpose of the Edict of Tolerance was to make Jews useful to the state. So Jews could now attend schools and universities and become merchants and own factories. Obviously the latter existed before, but not officially, and not necessarily sanctioned by the government. He did also demand, though, that the Hebrew and Yiddish languages be replaced by native languages. So other countries are even more expansive, but most, not all. The emancipation never came to Russia and most of Eastern Europe, so those Jews, Russia, Poland, Lithuania, never enjoyed the discussion, much less the freedoms. It should be noted that Tsar Alexander II, who's known as Alexander the Liberator, 1855-1881 were the years of his reign, he was the most benign to Jews of all the Russian Tsars, especially coming after the predations of his father, Nicholas I. So Alexander II abolished the cantonist schools, and he freed the serfs, and he tried to make the judiciary fair, and he opened high schools and universities to some Jews, and he was still assassinated in 1881, for which the Jews were blamed. Of the 10 conspirators, one happened to be Jewish, but she and the others were anarchists. She was not acting out of some patriotism towards the Jewish people. Alexander II was succeeded by Tsar Alexander III, who reversed the reforms, and his minister, Konstantin Pobedonetsev, famously stated the aim of the Russian government with regard to the Jews was that, I quote, "one-third will die out, one-third will leave the country, and one-third will be completely dissolved in the surrounding population," meaning either death or departure or assimilation. And even Alex II's reforms were not intended not to benefit the Jews, but in fact to benefit Russia. And this pattern repeated itself. Many reforms were less for the sake of the Jews than for the prosperity of the country that assumed that more rights for Jews would benefit them economically. So to give one example where it really did work out, the Rothschilds were among the families that took advantage of these opportunities, with the patriarch of the family, a native of Frankfurt, Meir Amschel Rothschild, who's a money changer and a coin dealer, who branched into textile manufacturing in Britain, and with that into British society. So Rothschild sent his son, Nathan Mayer, to England to handle his affairs there, and he established a private bank in England that soon expanded from London to Paris to Vienna and Naples and, of course, Frankfurt, each branch in each city run by one of the Rothschild brothers, sons of Meir Amschel. Among other things, actually he ran the one in Frankfurt, among other things, they financed Europe's wars on all sides, not only making a fortune, but also making themselves indispensable. Their wealth was in paper, not physical assets, so it could not be seized. And for over a century, the family basically intermarried, all cousins. So they were spared the fate of so many other Jews in Europe who saw the prospects of emancipation, of freedom, but also its limitations. In other words, terms like equality and rights were bandied about, but in many societies it still came with restrictions that pertained only to Jews, meaning certain positions were only open to Christians who openly professed a belief in Christianity. It's not well known, but even in the United States, which was founded on equality, not all states permitted Jews to vote or serve in office unless they took a Christian oath. So, for example, Maryland only annulled its restrictions in what was called the Jew Bill, formerly an act to extend to the sect of people professing the Jewish religion the same rights and privileges enjoyed by Christians. That act was only passed in 1826 by the Maryland General Assembly, which is 50 years after the Declaration of Independence and almost 40 years after the Constitution was adopted. Only then were Jews allowed to hold public office in the state. Shouldn't wonder about the First Amendment, which begins, "Congress shall not." The Bill of Rights was not applied to the states for quite some time. And even then, not all at once, what's called the Incorporation Doctrine. So in much of emancipated Europe, Jews suffered under these disabilities, even with the legislated freedoms that more than 250,000 Jews converted to Christianity in the 19th century alone. Conversion became the ticket to full entry into society, and even societies that purportedly claimed that Jews had the same rights as other citizens. So two great examples are offered by Paul Johnson in A History of the Jews. One, Benjamin Disraeli was baptized in 1817. Give me one second. In 1817, at age 12, by his father, Isaac, who was in some feud with Beavis Mark Synagogue in London. Disraeli became a member of parliament in 1837. Had he remained a Jew, he likely never would have been prime minister, as Jews were not permitted to serve in parliament until 1858. On the continent, a little after, August 24th, 1824, Karl Marx, who was then 6 years old, was converted with his family in Trier, where his grandfather had been the chief rabbi, and his uncle still was the chief rabbi. So Marx's father, Heinrich, was a trained lawyer, but Jews could not practice law, even after emancipation in Prussia. So the Marxes converted, and for reasons too long to go into now, while Disraeli admired his Jewish heritage, Marx despised it. For many Jews remaining Jewish became a material hardship, and emancipation exacerbated that situation and presented them with an avenue of escape. So in early 19th century Germany, the smallest steps towards freedom led to a stampede of heresy and assimilation, aided by the nascent reform movement. So on the one hand, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch was a member of parliament in Moravia. On the other hand, when he began in Frankfurt, there were barely a dozen Shomrei Shabbat families left. And the equality movement, such as it existed, brought out new waves of Jew haters. Which brings us to France, which in a sense encapsulated all of the possibilities and pitfalls of freedom for Jews. The French Revolution in 1789 saw the overthrow of the French monarchy, limitations on the power and influence of the church, and the establishment of a secular republic that was premised on equality for all citizens. In that same year, the French Assembly passed, famously, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, drafted by the Marquis de Lafayette, who fought in the American Revolution, and was inspired by Thomas Jefferson. Article 1 should ring a bell. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be founded only upon the general good. This sounds great, and after much debate and conflict, citizenship and equality were offered to Jews in 1791 in France. The Jews eagerly embraced it. But it came at a very steep price, and it portended a struggle that exists until today. What's the difference between being a Jew and being a Frenchman, an American, a Brit, or anything else? Is it possible to become a full citizen and yet maintain the social distance that Jews must have in terms of marriage, food, Shabbat, holidays, etc.? If there's a conflict, so what gives? All right, to suggest one approach, Rav Soloveitchik famously said, like Avram said, I'm a stranger and a sojourner in your midst. I'm a stranger when it comes to matters of religious practice or doctrine. But I'm a resident, a sojourner, just like you, when it comes to societal needs, the common good, and shared interests. But that's easier articulated than it is implemented, and French Jewry largely failed and began to deteriorate spiritually. If we are an am and a dat, a nation and a faith, a religion, once the component of nationhood is diluted, I'm a Frenchman, I'm a German of the Mosaic persuasion, soon after the dat is compromised, well, Shmir HaMitzvah disappears. And the Mosaic persuasion becomes just that, a persuasion that persuades no one. Both France and Germany wrestled with the issue of rights for Jews for decades. And of course, in Germany had a very unhappy outcome. Some parliamentarians favored full equality and others supported human rights, but not political and civil rights, suggesting that Jews were exiled from Israel and still yearned to return there, and so they could never be the same as other citizens. In one famous iteration of this, the Count Stanislas de Clermont-Tonnerre enunciated really what was Napoleon's view. To Jews as a nation, nothing. To the Jews as individuals, everything. So this conflict was brought to the fore by Napoleon, who favored equality for Jews, but he perceived Judaism as an obstacle to Jews perceiving themselves as equal to other Frenchmen. So in 1806, he called for the establishment of an assembly of Jewish notables, what he called the Great Sanhedrin, which would help define what the status of Jews could be in a free society. And he was at the height of his power, right after his great victory at Austerlitz, and he was dominant, the dominant figure in Europe. And he wanted Jewish notables from across Europe to join and resolve the Jewish question. Few did outside of France. On February 9th, 1807, this Sanhedrin, so to speak, convened in Paris. 71 Jews, including 46 rabbis, many liberal, but the leader was Rav David Zinsheim, who's the chief rabbi of Strasbourg and the author of the Yad David. Napoleon sent a list of 12 questions to which he sought official answers that would bind all French Jews, questions that we still wrestle with today. What were the questions and what were the answers? They're provocative. Some could be answered straightforward. Others, the Sanhedrin had to finesse with diplomatese, and others they fudged and they deliberated for 2 months. Question: is it lawful for Jews to have more than one wife? All right, simple enough. They answered, since Rabbeinu Gershom, polygamy is forbidden to Jews. Is divorce allowed in the Jewish religion? And if it is it allowed even in contradiction to the codes of French law? They answered, divorce by Jewish law is valid only after the previous divorce of the civil authorities. All right, that was false. That's not true. Third, does Jewish law permit a Jewess to marry a Christian man, or a Jew to marry a Christian woman, or may they marry only other Jews? Well, the answer seems obvious, but what they answered Napoleon, and think of the sensitivity of the question, marriage is contracted between Israelites and Christians are binding, although they cannot be celebrated with religious forms. So it's false. It's binding only under civil law. It's not binding under Jewish law at all. Ein kiddush and tavsin. 4 and 5, in the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen who are not Jewish considered to be their brethren or strangers? 5, what type of conduct does Jewish law prescribe toward non-Jewish Frenchmen? And they answered, every Israelite is religiously bound to consider his non-Jewish fellow citizens as brothers and to aid, protect, and love them as if they were co-religionists. That too is false. 6, do the Jews who are born in France and have been granted citizenship by the laws of France truly acknowledge France as their country? Are they bound to defend it, to follow its laws, to follow the directions of the civil and court authorities of France? Answer. The Israelite is required to consider the land of his birth or adoption as his fatherland and shall love and defend it when called upon. Well, this is mostly false. As citizens, we can certainly defend our adopted land, but the answer was tantamount to a rejection of Shivat Zion, the return to Zion. As odd, in a sense, since Napoleon himself declared in 1799 that the Jews were the rightful heirs of Palestine, which he then attempted to conquer. How far did the Jews take it? The answer continued. The love of the country is in the heart of Jews a sentiment so natural, so powerful, and so consonant to their religious opinions that a French Jew considers himself in England as among strangers, although he may be among Jews. And the case is the same with English Jews in France. To such a pitch is this sentiment carried among them that during the last war, French Jews have been seen fighting desperately against other Jews, the subjects of countries then at war with France. Many of them were covered with honorable wounds, and others have obtained in the field of honor the noble rewards of bravery. Well, it's a nice expression, and certainly Jews are patriots, but to say that a Jew feels no bond to a Jew in another land because they don't share the same secular nationality, that's completely bogus. 7, who elects rabbis? Every shul wrestles with this. This mode of election is not, however, uniform. It varies according to place, and to this day, whatever concerns the elections of rabbis is still in a state of uncertainty. It's probably true in many shuls too. What kind of judicial power do rabbis exercise over the Jews? That's a loaded question as well. The answer, the rabbis exercise no manner of police jurisdiction among the Jews. Sometimes in the dispersion, I mean the exile, a rabbi and two other doctors formed a kind of tribunal named Beit Din, that is, House of Justice. The rabbi fulfilled the functions of judge, and the other two those of his assessors. The attributes and even the existence of these tribunals have to this day always depended on the will of government under which the Jews have lived and on the degree of tolerance they have enjoyed. Since the revolution, those rabbinical tribunals are totally suppressed in France, and in Italy, the Jews, raised to the ranks of citizens, have conformed in everything to the laws of the state, and accordingly the functions of rabbis, get this, wherever any are established, are limited to preaching morality in the temples, blessing marriages, and pronouncing divorces. Oy, the hatchim, latchim, dispatchim mode of the rabbinate. You're there for the brit, the wedding, and the funeral. 9. If there is rabbinical jurisdiction over the Jews, is it regulated by the laws of the Jewish religion, or is it merely a custom existing among Jews? They said, refer to question 8. Are there professions from which Jews are excluded by Jewish law? None. In fact, the father does not teach a profession to his child, rears him up to be a villain. 11. Does Jewish law prohibit Jews from taking usury from other Jews? Interest of any kind, not just usury, may not be taken. And finally, number 12. Does Jewish law prohibit Jews from taking usury from non-Jews? And this is the longest and most convoluted answer, and it was an especially sore point with Napoleon. So they first said, we're generally forbidden, always on the score of charity, to lend upon interest to our fellow citizens of different persuasions, as well as to our fellow Jews. Well, that, of course, is false. But they continued that there are Jews who would lend money on interest to Gentiles, but just because some Jews do it doesn't make it part of our religious doctrine any more than what some Christians do represent evangelical doctrine. I quote, but if there are some not over nice in this particular, is it just to accuse 100,000 individuals of this vice? Would it not be deemed an injustice to lay the same imputation on all Christians because some of them are guilty of usury? End quote. Of course, the correct answer is that Jews don't lend to Jews with interest because we're all family. Perhaps they could have expressed that, or that might have been counterproductive to this entire exchange. But in the end, the answers that they gave to these very volatile questions did not really represent the Torah view, and itself became the initial distortion, the doctrinal distortion of Torah for French Jewry. What this question and answer and Napoleon's entire endeavor concluded was that, in essence, Jews could be free and equal if we relinquish some or all of our Jewishness. Some of our faith, some of our mitzvot, some of our uniqueness, and that was a trap, but one into which many Jews fell. Soon after, Napoleon disbanded the Sanhedrin, and he restricted Jewish freedoms, and he forgave all debts that were owed to Jews. But the broader problem remained encapsulated in a famous machloket in the rabbinic world during the second decade of the 19th century. So Napoleon invaded Russia, and when he did that, most rabbis in Eastern Europe supported Napoleon, if only because they hated the Tsar so much. So remember, this was less than 2 decades since Jews had been confined in the Pale of Settlement and drastically limited in their educational and economic opportunities. So supporting Napoleon against the Tsar made sense up to a point. But a major dissenter was the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Baal HaTanya. He opposed Napoleon's invasion of Russia. He opposed Napoleon. He openly prayed for the success of the evil Tsar, Alexander I. Why? So the Rebbe called Napoleon. He said, "He's satana min aged becholid nagdud elatov, v'shekol chiyuto lefol rakra." Napoleon is a Satan who opposes everything good, whose life is dedicated only to do evil. How so? The Baal HaTanya reasoned that Napoleon's liberal reforms were good for the Jews as individuals, but bad for the Jewish people. Napoleon's commitment to equality for Jews, the Rebbe felt, would lead to widespread assimilation and estrangement from God. So if France triumphs, tarbeh hapikarsut b'Yisrael, heresy will multiply, proliferate in Israel. And worse, lo yisher echad biyaduto, no one will remain Jewish. He even tried to rally support for the Tsar, which is an uphill battle for Russian and Polish Jews, despite because of the Tsar's hatred for, and the Balatanya said, the Tsar may persecute Jews, and he may hate Jews, but at least they will remain Jews. This is an historic question, not easily answered. Is it worse for Jews to be threatened physically or threatened spiritually? We should avoid simplistic answers. For one thing, this is the two holidays we have, Hanukkah and Purim. They're equal holidays. But this question also animated Jews who considered leaving Egypt for the Golden Medina. On the one hand, they'll enjoy freedom. On the other hand, that freedom could, and judging by the numbers, usually did, mean freedom from being Jews, from living a Jewish life, and even freedom to redefine Judaism to make it palatable to modern life. The Alter Rebbe was clear. We have to prioritize the Jewish soul. In a letter to Rav Moshe Meisels in Vilna, who was urging the Rebbe to abandon his support for Napoleon and join the battle against the Tsar, which overwhelmingly the rabbis of Eastern Europe supported, the Rebbe answered, "If Bonaparte prevails, you are Be'er Ha'osher B'Yisrael, V'Yarum Keren Yisrael. Jews will become wealthy and proud. Avol Yitpardu V'Yidrachaku Libon Shel Yisrael Me'avin Shebashamayim. But they will become alienated from their Father in Heaven. But Im Yinatzeach Adonenu Alexander, but if our master Alexander prevails, Im ki yarbe ha'oni b'Yisrael, v'yushpal keren Yisrael, Jews will be poor, and no doubt they'll be humiliated. Aval yitkashru v'yitchabru v'yitakdu liban shel Yisrael lavi en shebashamayim. They will remain more connected to their Father in Heaven." All this is from a sefer called Harav Mila'adu Mifleget Chabad. So the proof, the Rebbe said, was in how Napoleon was conscripting Jews, whereas the Tsar would not do such a thing. Such was his hatred of the Jewish people. Well, that turned out to be incorrect, as Alexander's son Nicholas I, less than two decades later, began forcibly conscripting Jews. And the Rebbe's statement that the Tsar rotze lachazik datei Yehudim, he wants to strengthen the faith of Jews because he himself is a believer, that was obviously mocked by Nicholas's efforts to forcibly convert Jews, but this happened decades after the Rebbe died. Most rabbis disagree with the Alter Rebbe, as the loss of life to persecution is as real as the absence of loss of life to persecution in free societies is real. Meaning, Bari Vashema, Bari Adif. You know that Jews are going to die because of persecution. You don't necessarily know that they will assimilate. The spiritual loss is always speculative, not definite. And a dead Jew learns no Torah and performs no mitzvot, and lo meitim yahaluluka. And yet, were the Rebbe's fears completely misguided? If we look what happened in Europe, and a century and two centuries later in America. So he did convince Rav Meisels in Vilna, but the suffering unleashed by the Tsars, after Napoleon was defeated, devastated Jewish life. The sentence of poverty drove Jews to convert and assimilate and otherwise shirk observance of Torah in the wake of the Haskalah, and then socialism, and then communism, and then secular Zionism. Many Jews rebelled against this notion that somehow persecution is good for us, and understandably so, which is not to say that the sentiment is wrong. The Gemara says in Megillah, Daf Yodalid, Gedola hasarat tabat yoter mi'arbim v'shmona nevi'im v'sheva nevi'ot shenit nabu lohen li'Yisrael shekulon lo hechzirun lamutav. The Gemara says that when Ahasuerus gave his signet ring to Haman, that was a greater catalyst for tshuva than all the words combined of the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses, none of whom succeeded in returning Jews to God. But when Ahasuerus gave his ring, that worked, because now Jews knew something was up. As many have said, ultimately it makes little difference to a nation whether its soldiers die in battle or throw off their uniforms and defect to the other side. Both a loss to the nation. Demographically, it's been estimated that just in the last century alone, we've lost 6 million American Jews to assimilation and intermarriage and the concomitant loss of children. That number, 6 million, should ring a bell. And that is one price that we pay for freedom. In summary, we've been trying to resolve this dilemma now for more than 200 years, and the early returns are not good. To take another example, just compare the number of 19th century Gedolim in France, very, very few. In Germany, slightly more, and those were the relatively free societies, to the number of Gedolim in Poland and Russia, Lithuania, etc., around the same time. Try to name a sefer still used today that emanated from France in the 19th century compared to the vast number from Eastern Europe. Equality only came to Polish and Russian Jews, at least nominally, after World War I. The Alter Rebbe's fears were valid and proven. What he lacked was a healthy alternative. So here's the conundrum. No sane person would choose to live in a repressive society. Even though it's easier on some level to live a Jewish life under authoritarian rule, as long as they prefer to leave us alone and don't suppress Torah or mitzvot, it's hard to say that Judaism can thrive under those circumstances. It's constricted. The temptation to flee hardship is great, and the Holocaust should forever gainsay the notion that persecution and hatred will just wash over us. The flood of hatred that washes over us can also drown us. On the other hand, look at the wonderful opportunities that freedom provides, and the last century has been a blessing in that sense. Endless opportunities, legal protection for Shabbat observers, affluence that has made the observance of mitzvot easier, from the lucrative kashrut industry to Pesach programs, the availability of tefillin, arba minim, anything a Jew wants. We're not that removed chronologically from the time when Poskim dealt with the issue of how do you handle a town that has one etrog and there's a question as to the kashrut of that one etrog. It's not that remote. And this year I bought two because I found one was more mahudr than the first one that I bought. So both sides of this conundrum are amply illustrated by the American Jewish experience. We have the freedom to educate our children with minimal interference. We even have kosher food in federal prison for those who need it. We can achieve an enormous wealth that is not arbitrarily confiscated by the government, as well as the freedom to renounce any semblance of Jewish identity and practice, and these days still claim you're a good Jew. The freedoms of America and much of the world today are unparalleled in Jewish history, and so is the price paid in knowledge and commitment to and observance of Torah. I think it was Irving Kristol who said that the problem in America is not that the Goyim want to kill us, but that they want to marry us. So it's not perfect, you know, even in America, even with the Constitution and when the Bill of Rights extended, we all know there was still social ostracism and there were quotas and Jews country clubs, etc. But now it's a situation that's gone beyond even freedom. There was an article in Tablet magazine a few months ago by Danny Shift, who said that Jews went in America from the 19th century from partial emancipation to what he called today hyper-emancipation. That Jews feel more accepted in America, but not more attached to Judaism or to the Jewish community. And that's a terrible price to pay. Mendelssohn, in his time, pushed Jews into the general culture, thinking that it would not harm their observance. But he knew how to make Kiddush. He didn't know how to make Havdalah, keeping what has to be separate, separate. His children could not even make Kiddush. We would rather serve God amid plenty than amid hardship. But can it be sustained? Is the tendency too great when things are good, to forget God, Vayishman Yeshurun Vayavot, and go our own way, thinking that there'll be no consequences. How we answer that question will determine who and how many survive until Mashiach comes. So what are the effects of freedom? It reminds me of a story that Henry Kissinger told. In one of his first meetings with Chou Enlai, the Chinese foreign minister in the early 1970s, they were shooting the breeze, and Kissinger asked Zhou what he thought were the long-term effects of the French Revolution that had occurred 180 years earlier. And Zhou answered, "It's too soon to tell." What are the long-term effects of freedom and emancipation for Jews? There's been much positive and much negative, but we have to answer as well, "It's too soon to tell." That wraps up the series for this year. I thank everyone who joined, all those who listen on YU Torah as well. Thank again Becky and Avi Katz, and I bid you all good night and Hatzlacha Rabbah. Be well.